Welcome to the Technori Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Catoon. This is a special podcast. It's rare. We have a lot of awesome founders on the show all the time, but it is rare that we get someone who's like in the billions with a B. Victor Ciardelli is the founder of many things, but also a big one, Guaranteed Rate. You're a Sox fan, you probably know Guaranteed Rate Field, rate.com. Guaranteed Rate is, we joke about it on the show, but it's the seventh largest lender for residential. They're gigantic. And his story is so fascinating. We talk a little bit about Wayne Huizenga, if you're familiar with the Huizenga family, and Waste Management's the largest garbage truck and waste management company, I think, in the world. And it all started with one garbage truck. And very similarly, Victor basically kind of did the same thing. He turns like one loan into a business that kind of grows into a bigger business, which kind of grows into the idea to become a bigger one. And then fast forward, 8 years later, and they got this gigantic company, and it's just crushing. And he's also got a very interesting backstory, which I think you will all learn a lot from. So I will not even spoil it. You can listen to the show because it is well worth your time. We are going to jump right into the startup inbox portion of the show. It is brought to you by ActiveCampaign. See why 65,000 businesses, including Technori, use ActiveCampaign for their marketing by signing up at activecampaign.com/Technori. Get your first 2 months for free. Very fitting question. What do I need to know about loans? By Jim Robel. I'd like to be able to secure a loan for my startup business. What type of loans or credit? I should have read this before Victor left. I should have had him answer this question. Obviously, Guaranteed Rate is a different business. They're in residential and commercial loans, not necessarily business loans or individual loans, although I'm sure that he probably could write a loan for just about anybody. I hate these kind of questions as far as advice because I don't want to send you in the wrong direction. I can tell you that personally, I wanted to start a business. I went out and talked to everybody I possibly could, and they told me it was a stupid idea. No, 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 no. And I took that as a yes, you guys just don't see it. But I didn't have any money, and my parents are not in a position where I could ask them for a bunch of their money. And so what I ultimately did was I took out a credit card like a fool. $65,000, I threw it down, and I launched the business, and I just said the hell with it. And it has worked out. That money is more or less paid back. I don't know that that's the right thing for everybody to do. For me, I just knew that I saw the path. And I knew the amount of money that I needed to take out was not so much that I couldn't pay it back over time. It wasn't going to be a burden, really. And that was on my person, there wasn't a business loan. I didn't have a business. If your business hasn't been around long enough, you're not going to get a business loan. So that answers the question really quickly. But I will say, now thinking about it, the one thing that Victor talked about in the show that I think you should listen to, and this is he's in college, and then after college, he was trying to decide what business he should start. And he went through the yellow pages, and he said he looked for all the different types of businesses he could start that required no upfront capital. My advice to you, I don't know, Jim, what your business is or what stage it's at. My advice to you is to try to start the business, or at least start a revenue model within the business, which could be short term. It doesn't have to be the scalable part of the business. Find the spot within the business that takes no capital and try to get that going. And if you can prove that you can sell, which is the first question, then after that you can go back and maybe sell people on raising capital or whatever the case. Regardless, my only advice on the raising or taking money via loan, I think strategically it makes sense when you can see without any crazy projection a path to paying it back. If you don't see that, man, you might be nutty, but hey, you got to do you, bro. This is going to be my probably one of the best interviews I think we've done yet. That's just my opinion. Victor Ciardelli, founder and CEO of Guaranteed Rate. I think it's interesting to find out about the founders themselves, and there's like these weird intricacies that happen in your life that sort of like drive you to be who you are, but ultimately the companies that we see, the good ones and the really shitty ones, they all have like a common element, which is like there's a flaw that the leader has, which could be good or bad for the company, depends. And you sort of see it come out. And so the hope in this conversation is to learn more about you and your life and Guaranteed Rate and the foundation and sort of all the things that you guys are into.
Okay.
Sweet?
Yeah.
All right, we can roll right into it. I have to say the first and foremost thing is Guaranteed Rate is a sponsor of the White Sox.
Right.
I grew up a White Sox fan. It's Comiskey Park to me still, But Guaranteed Rate, rate.com, I can get on. If you can convince me to call it Guaranteed Rate Field, this is the podium for it.
You know what? I'm fine. I don't call it Comiskey. Sometimes, every once in a while, I call it White Sox, Park, yeah. So I'm good with whatever anybody feels. I'm not trying to convince anybody to do anything as far as the name goes.
Just check out rate.com afterward. That's all.
Yeah. I mean, from a branding perspective, that's why we did it. Yep. And it's worked out really well, as far as people correlate the name of the stadium with the name of the company. And it provided, great brand. It was funny right off the bat when the name was announced. A lot of the fans didn't like the down arrow. Yep. Thought it represented something negative.
How things have been going for the Sox.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Turn that Guaranteed Rate arrow back up.
Yeah, and there was points where we were trending on Twitter, and it was all this news. And so people said, there's a lot of negativity. I was like, well, there's no negativity as it relates to the business. Yeah. It said, it had to do with the fact that the logo had an arrow pointing down and it's fine. It was great. It gave us national publicity and national recognition from a brand perspective, and things have kind of leveled off, and we haven't heard anything negative about it. We love the partnership. The organization's fantastic. Jerry Reinsdorf is an absolute class act. The White Sox are doing great. The fans are awesome. So, I mean, we could not be happier with...
My first job was with Reinsdorf's real estate company.
Was it really?
Yeah. It was a company that he had started, and then it got sold to... You might know some of these people in the real estate kind of spaces, but Bernard Katz and Associates bought it, and Bernie Katz was rebuilding all of Bucktown.
Yeah.
And then Dale Dobrow took that over, called it Sidcor, and I got in right in between Bernie and Dale, and that was sort of the line. So I've had the chance to meet Jerry several times, and like you said, just a really, really good guy, loyal guy.
Yeah, very authentically, he's a great person.
Well, I'm glad to hear it's working out, because that I think it's one of those interesting things. The branding on stadiums is always a hot button, and some companies have a name that it works, and some just don't.
Right.
And some are it becomes legendary. Really, like it becomes legendary.
Yeah.
All I know about Guaranteed Rate is that. Not the company, but the sponsorship, is that WGN obviously airs the White Sox games, and I host a show on Saturdays, a live show, and I don't host it whenever the White Sox play, so I always know, all right, I get to watch the game today, and that. And so when I heard you guys were sponsoring it, it's exciting to me because I come from, obviously, the tech space. Yeah. And so it's nice for me to see brands that I'm familiar with and stories I'm familiar with starting to actually be public and not just be this little ecosystem we live in.
Oh, I appreciate that. Yeah, it's great. Yeah, I mean, it's... for us to be able to have awareness of our brand through what we're doing too, as relates to the company, and the fact that people would go to rate.com and actually, I want to know a little bit more about that organization and then get to know us, hopefully they're going to the site and kind of authentically saying, these guys seem like they're, they actually care about us as a customer and they're going to do a good job. And
I also think it's a good fit. In this particular case, I think of Brooklyn Nets and Barclays, that to me doesn't line up, but Guaranteed Rate and in particular Southside, and in particular Southsiders, I feel like is actually a really good fit.
Yep.
Which is another kind of rarity. So my point is, keep sponsoring is my
Thank
point.
Thank you. We
enjoy it.
Yeah, great.
So I want to get to know you as best I can in the time that we have allowed here, and ask you sort of, what is your background? What did your parents do? Where'd you grow up? I would like to know as much as I can about you.
Yeah. So, I grew up, actually in the suburbs of Chicago in area of Oak Brook.
Oh, Glen Ellyn, West suburbs.
Here. All right.
Our last guest before you came in was a Hinsdale guy. He's like, oh, Glenbird West or Glenbird South. I was like, South.
I live in Hinsdale now.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
There you go. Full circle.
So, yeah.
I love Hinsdale.
Yeah, it's a nice community. I mean, for kids growing up, it's great. They get out of school, they walk down into town, and,
You a golf guy there in Hinsdale?
No. I'm really kind of a city guy that just got placed in Hinsdale. And, it was...
I know how that goes.
Yeah. I went out there kicking and screaming, and then it was funny when I first went out there. come on, let's just go check out this house. And I remember the swing, the kids were, I brought all the kids out, and the kids are running in the yard, and they jumped on the swing set, and they're going, I'm like, all right, we're done. Fine, we're doing it.
Do you know
what
guy to get a loan, though? Like, is it easy for you to get? Can we get a refi here? I don't know. Just rate.com is a small site you can check out.
Right.
So you're from here. Your parents, are they entrepreneurial? What was the kind of
exact opposite? My dad is an attorney.
Okay.
And I'm not saying it's in all cases attorneys, but mainly as attorneys, they will talk you out of doing anything entrepreneurial, then talk you into it, right?
Yes.
So I grew up.
That's why we pay them so much. They keep us out of trouble.
Right. That's right.
It's usually a bad idea. It just gets some we hung around long enough to get lucky, and then
exactly.
It worked out.
Yeah. I didn't fit the mold, I guess, as you would think, as a CEO, entrepreneur, or maybe I do, I don't know, but
we're going to find out.
Yeah.
That's the point.
Yeah. So, I kind of grew up being rebellious, you know, not really fitting into anything that anybody who was over the age of probably 30 telling me to do anything. I absolutely decided to do the opposite. And even if it made sense for me, I would do the opposite. So, and by doing that, it just, made my life a lot harder than it needed to be.
I actually think that this goes back to, we talk about this on the show all the time. Many, many founders, I'm sure you know Al Goldstein. That's probably a name from Avant. Al, do you know Al?
Of course.
There's no way you don't know Al.
Yeah. And I just, I appreciate Al because he supported his CFO, just came over, and he's our new CFO.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So Al and Adam Hughes came on the show not that long ago, and it's the same story. It's like basically these guys told me how to run a business, and I was like, F you. That's not how I run a business. And so if I hadn't started off with some of the companies the way that they built them and dealt with the turmoil and things, as the snowball gets bigger and bigger and bigger, the problems tend to be bigger and bigger, and they crush you faster. Mm. And so he's like, if I didn't go through so many challenges, and I liken my own story to this too, like if I didn't make life a total bitch to get through, at this point, I would fold
accurate.
All the time.
100% accurate. No, when we went through different parts of, we almost went out of business, multiple times, like three times really. And I would say, especially in the crash, right? When everything was going against us, and statistically, we should not be in business today, right? And we just shouldn't be. And a lot of the reason why we ended up surviving was because my past, my history, the stuff I went through.
Scrambler.
A scrapper and, grit and, just kind of grinding things through and having the attitude of like, we're doing this. There's no chance that this is going to fail. We're going to make this work, and just rally the entire team, just not allowing anything to get in the way of the ultimate goal. So, and that, growing up in the background and everything I went through, was a perfect, training ground as far as to be able to, be ready for that.
I mean, I don't know your educational background, but I look at many, it's in paper. I just didn't look at it. I could know your educational background. I just don't in this particular instance. I'm not saying that hiring big gun MBAs and things is not good for some businesses, but I think that a lot of institutional, depending on where you go to school, a lot of institutions focus on trying to teach you how to be a design thinker out of the box. And the reality is the only way to actually be like an applicable operator using that is that you've reverse engineered your way out of a jam on a multitude of times.
Yeah.
And so I don't know if they could have trained you to run guaranteed rate in 2019.
No chance. No. And honestly, when you think about my educational background, it was an educational background that really didn't exist.
Yeah.
So I was
maybe that's why I didn't know.
Yeah. I mean, I was so rebellious that I refused to do anything that any, so when I, when I went through high school, and I'm pretty open about it, I don't remember doing any homework. I don't remember doing anything of any sorts. So my high school, our graduating class, I guess, was the worst graduating class as far as the percentage of kids that went to college.
Yeah.
And my GPA was second to last of my entire graduating.
So you were they say the best of the best. You were the wrong stuff. You were the worst.
I went to a Catholic high school, and it was like taking me and who I was at the time. I was like just, you know, absolutely a ticking time bomb.
Yep.
And you take me and you put me in an environment that, you know, the building didn't have any windows.
Yep.
And it was run by Christian Brothers, and it's very, you know, you know, telling you how to do everything. It didn't go well.
I suspect not.
Yeah. So you know, I had conversations with my high school counselor. You know, I remember going in there, and he would talk about, you know, golf and, you know, how are you at putting and things like that. And I said, you know, I don't get it. Like, are we talking about college? He's like, yeah, well, Victor, there's really not much to talk about. You can't get into a college, you know? So
I had a same story. I was I'm like the C student, like extraordinaire. No homework, nothing. I remember, it's so funny, this makes me feel better. I remember my mom and me being like, all my friends are going to U of I, and they're all going to like wherever they're going, Notre Dame and all this stuff. And I'm like, I want to go to U of I. And my mom's like, you're a senior and you're going to college at DuPage because your shit is weak. Like, you didn't even take the ACT. Like, this isn't going to work, man.
Yeah.
I just it didn't line up to me. And it's funny, like, I don't think it's not the Mark Zuckerbergs and all these famous people who dropped out of school. There's just some people, and it's really hard to identify them, I think, for teachers. Educators are used to line and rank and file. They have a hard time identifying that, like, square peg round hole person who's like, in your world, every attribute that made you not successful in their world is what makes you successful in your world now. And I think there's a rare breed of people who that's the case.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and it wasn't that I couldn't do it. It's just that I refused to do it, you know? And luckily there was a college, it's called Columbia College in Columbia, Missouri. And where they did accept me, actually. And so when I got out there, I was like, all right, nobody knows me here. You know, all I'm doing is hurting myself. I need to get my act together. And so at that point, I actually, while everybody else was out of their minds, you know, partying as a freshman.
You already got that out of you.
Yeah, I mean, I was partying pretty hard before that. So at that point, I'm like, I got to get this together. And I had to catch up for lost time. So I worked harder than I normally had to work. And I ended up doing really well, considering.
Was it the fresh start that, like, was there a moment, or was there like, I'm here and it's like, you know what? Like, what the hell am I doing?
Yeah, it was.
And there's no pressure from others because you don't have to, you can be whoever you want to be now.
Yeah. Because
they don't know you.
Honestly, and it was really like going, okay, you know, I who I was being was a representation of so much other things that were the reasons why I was acting kind of the way I was. So then I got to a point, I was like, I know fundamentally and authentically, this is not who I am as a person, and it just doesn't feel right. And I need to, like, you know, get back to, you know, taking care of myself and, you know, focusing on what really matters. And I'm still working on it today. So
that's a forever battle. It's a work in progress. You know? I mean, it should be forever, right? You're always trying to learn. So you finish up school. What's the first real job you get?
So I finished. So through college, I did all sorts of stuff. You know, I painted the street address numbers on curbs, you know, and it was an awesome way to make money.
With permission or without?
So I did it first without, and then the city of Columbia, Missouri, you know, got on me and said, no, it's got to be more controlled. So I would go in there and highlight the streets that I would take, and I'd pay them a nominal dollar amount fee. And then I would go around and paint them, go around and ring doorbells, and you know, I had the whole pitch down as far as asking people for money. And then, you know, I said it was a donation. I said, you know, my pitch was, hey, you know, I went around the neighborhood, painted the street address numbers on the curbs. I do it as a service for the community, and I also do it to put myself through school, and I'd like to see if you'd be willing to give a small donation. So people would give, you know, $1 or $2 or something. And then I had somebody complain that's not okay, and they called the city. And then, of course, then the city said, you know, Victor, you need to get approval, you know, and ask people first before you do it. And I said, well, it doesn't make sense that it, financially, you know, it just wouldn't
work. It's a bad sales model.
Yeah. So I just kept going ahead and keep doing it until they finally shut me down.
What's the number of people who are going to complain? You know,
right, exactly.
I can paint 52 people in one day. I'll be already ahead by the time you catch
me. Yeah, exactly. And then another summer I went through the Yellow Pages. And I flipped through the Yellow Pages and I figured out every business I could start that didn't have any upfront capital, right? So I wrote them all down. So painting is one of them, right? There's a bunch of them. And one of them was tarring driveways. So I used to tar my parents' driveway all the time. So I'm like, well, I know how to tar a driveway. Yeah. You know, I've done it a number of times. So I put together a business called Tar Star Blacktopping. And we had my parents had an extra line in the house. So I had my sister, you know, be the person that says
Tar Star Black Talk.
Yeah, yeah. How you call it? Star Tar Blacktopping. And sorry no one's there right now, but if you know, leave a message. So then when I wasn't getting the calls because I made flyers and put them all around. So then I would go ring doorbells. And because I was used to ringing the doorbells through doing the curb painting. And I would give free estimates. And then I was busy all summer. And I hired one of the guys I played football with in high school to help me out. And so that's what I did in the summers.
If I would have guessed before you came in here, I was like, there's no way this guy didn't sell cutlery. That was my guess. I would have said cutlery. No question.
Yeah.
I could see you cutting a penny in some old lady's kitchen like no one's business.
Yeah, right.
You need this.
I was willing to do whatever. You know, at the time, I was like, didn't care. If it made sense and I had flexibility, I was like, I'm in.
Stenciling curb numbers was definitely not.
Right.
That's now. I don't.
Right.
The whole scrolling through the Yellow Pages for a business that doesn't take upfront capital to me is like, That's a quote. I hope someone writes that down. That has to be the most original. And so you're doing this. Your dad or parents, I have to imagine they were like completely thrilled given the turnaround of what they were seeing before, that like there was, if nothing else, you were like taking an interest in something or not.
Yeah. Not really, but
they're like, this kid, he's just rolling around throwing tar on people's driveways.
Not so much, but it's all good.
So you're doing, it's like you do this through college.
Yeah.
And then after that, do you, I cannot imagine you like go off and to a recruiting agency and find a job. Like
No.
That, I just,
you know,
don't
it's
see
funny because I was, so there's a guy who, I knew growing up, but I didn't know him personally, but I knew of him. Through a friend of mine who was friends with him, is a guy named Wayne Huizinga. And Wayne started waste management with one garbage truck.
Still the
truck.
Only family with like three Fortune 500 companies, Public Trader too. There's that. What's the, there's waste management.
Did,
then there's.
Well, he did waste management. He did
obviously the Dolphins
Blockbuster
at
video.
One point, Blockbuster video.
Yeah. And then he did AutoNation USA.
That's what it was.
Yep. And then he did all these other ones too, like, which was like, smaller ones.
We don't count the non-Fortune 500. If you don't employ thousands of people, it didn't happen.
Exactly. Exactly. So, I mean, to see somebody like that take a single garbage truck and then build it into be the largest waste company in the world, you know, I was like, oh, if he did it,
why can't I?
He's a human being.
Tar scales.
Like,
everybody needs tar.
Yeah,
tar scales.
Like, why couldn't I do it, right? And so I had the thought process of being able to be a part of something that could scale, grow, you know. And so when I first got out, it was either I didn't know where I was going to go, but I wanted to either do that or be a developer and build skyscrapers. And, you know, I was always thinking big.
Yeah.
And so I actually got my commercial real estate license and I started selling commercial real estate. It's funny how things go, because if I had this one sale that I had, there's no way I'd be in the mortgage business today. And that was the kind of the pivotal point that left me open to other opportunities. And I had a guy that I worked with call me up and said, how's everything going? And this is back in 1991, yep. And there was the foreclosure rate on commercial properties and the vacancy rates of office buildings in the Loop was off the charts, yep. Right? It was crazy. So there's actually the area that I was working, which was the south Loop and the West Loop, there was more foreclosures in at that time than there
was
sales.
It was a completely different city. I mean, right. Across it's the board.
Completely, right? Completely. So he said, how you doing? I'm like, that deal I was working on, and it was over on, now I think it's called the Haymaker Lofts or something like that.
Yeah, Haymarket.
Yeah. The developer's awesome guy, gave me a shot to, you know, he didn't list the property with me, but gave me a shot to market it. And I ended up putting the deal together with a great developer, actually. And they just couldn't secure the financing because the market was so bad. Yeah. The banks just wouldn't get behind it. So at that point, you know, I ended up, broke, you know, in a bad spot. And the guy I worked with said, hey, why don't you try and get in the mortgage business? And
join the other side.
Right.
Couldn't get the financing, so I figured I'd finance my own.
Yeah, exactly. And so I was like, all right. I said, but I don't want to, I'm not sure I want to get into it full time. And he said, well, there's a telemarketing operation. He said, if you want, you can work at nights as a telemarketer. I said, yeah, that's perfect. I could just go check it out, work as a telemarketer. So I worked two nights as a telemarketer, and we're just making phone calls to homeowners and, you know, looking at doing debt consolidations, refinancing their loans. And I was just taking the information, passing it off to loan officers. And at the time, I was like, I think they had eight telemarketers there. I think I was matching the entire volume of all eight telemarketers.
That was going to be my follow-up on this. Is like, there's no way that you're not crushing it.
Yeah, crushing it.
I could just see this, like, pound the phone, just like, don't give a shit.
It just felt like no-brainer. I got this, you know?
It's like a Wolf of Wall Street thing going on here. Like, just can't help himself.
Yeah. And the guy's like, who owns a place? He's like, oh, my God, dude, you got to come work for me as a loan officer. And so I was like, I don't know. Let me think about it. So the guy who I worked with, I told him, I said, let's go have a beer, you know, after we're done. He's like, okay. So we went and had a beer, and I said, let's start our own mortgage company. And he starts laughing. He's like, dude, you're two nights here as a telemarketer. I'm only been here for like 3-4 months as a loan officer. He goes, what do we know about, I go,
to make sales, I know enough.
It seems so easy. I go, we got this. I go, this is not a problem. And so I convinced him to do it. And my thought process was, I'm broke already. Yeah. There's really no downside. Like, you know, what's gonna be the worst thing that could possibly happen?
Nothing.
Right? Nothing.
So the two questions that come to mind, like, first off, minus the multi-billion-dollar loan company that you own and the difference between you and I here. So I got into commercial real estate the exact same way.
Is that right?
It was a matter of like finding nuisance properties. This is right before the bubble burst. So it's like nuisance properties, flipping them to Walgreens and others in corner spots and just sort of like finding a niche. Only obviously the owners are getting exceedingly wealthy and I'm just sort of sitting there like, there's got to be another way to get in and like get equity in things. And obviously that's where the startup world came. But like I find this common thread with a lot of the successful founders is like they're scrappy. They have this constant, I don't know, it's like a bug, an itch, whatever it is. It's just like they have to disrupt something or they don't even think it's difficult. Where everyone else sees a barrier, they're like, I never even saw it. The one thing that I have found among a very small select breed of people, and you would definitely be one of them, is the sense of scale from day one.
Yeah.
Some people are told by investors, now how do we scale?
Yep.
And others are like from day one, like they wouldn't pursue it unless they saw the scalability.
Yeah, it's smart. Yeah, it's a good, that's so true.
Your end, like, I mean, what I'm seeing here is we talk about Wayne Huizenga.
Yep.
We're looking at one garbage truck into a fleet that's the size of the world. And I'm starting to see the picture of like one loan into the size of one of the largest loan writers in the world.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, honestly, people asked me today, said, you know, you're blown away with where you're at. And I'm like, I'm happy with where we're at. But we're really just getting started here. I mean, yeah. where the plan is to, you know, I mean, we set out to be the number one retail mortgage lender in the country, and you know we're like seventh right now. Yeah. So we got a long way to go.
What are you guys doing? Jesus, time's slipping, right? Man. Come on, get your game together. So let's talk a little bit about the actual business here and sort of the other things. I mean, obviously, I want to make sure that we get on the foundation stuff and some of the things you're passionate about now, because when you're starting businesses and you have nowhere to go but down, you still have passions. I have passions in different philanthropic things that I would love to get involved in, but you can't do good until you've made good or done good.
Yeah.
And so there are things that you probably always want to get to. And now, you know, I know you're only seventh place, but you probably are doing well enough that you guys can focus on some of the philanthropic stuff too. So tell those listening a little bit about Rate.com and just like what business you guys are in.
Yeah, so we're in the residential mortgage space, right? And we started 19 years ago. And with the concept of mind and being completely transparent to the consumer on rate and fee, right? And having a model where we're willing to take lower margins with the intent that it's, you know, it's kind of goodwill. It's good. It's all going to work out from a certain, having service go away.
Yeah.
You know, like to me, it's like you got to have phenomenal service. You got to have it ultimately comes down to, in the end, is the customer willing to refer their friends and family to you, right?
Yep.
And that was everything to us. So we wanted to build a platform where we really cared about the customer, making sure that by the time we're done, that they would refer us to their friends and family. We'd have offer low rates, no games, fixed fee, fully transparent, and then using technology in order to streamline the process and make it easier,
yep.
Right? I mean, essentially really what the model is. And we started up as a startup in 2000 and grown to be the seventh largest mortgage lender in the country. We funded $24 billion in loans last year. This year, we're on track to funding over $30 billion in loans. You know, so, and we're in every state in the country. Nationally, we have 5,000 employees, you know, and so yeah,
it's a nice little business.
Yeah, it's it. That's the business. Right.
It's interesting to me, the part about this, that for anyone, those listening who are on the entrepreneur track, which people listen to the show and they're thinking they want to learn from you. They want to hear sort of like, maybe it's not the same business as you're in, but they want to get into a different business and learn something. You've given all the trademarks away as far as like the kind of mindset you need to have, the ability to be sort of fleet and wanting to be scrappy and not caring really, and just like it's all or nothing kind of way of operating. I think that's key, because as a founder or a leader in any sort, like if you're not the one who's willing to run through the door and take the bullet first, then no one's going to follow you.
Mm.
From a business standpoint, what you said in the lending space, I think is particularly unique. If you've been if anyone's ever been in the position of dealing with lenders, customer service is probably not usually what I would recommend saying, like, that's what's so great. So you picking something that doesn't exist in lending, basically, and hanging your hat on it and saying, we are going to be the best customer facing lender on the planet.
Yeah.
Is a very hard task given the business, given the fact that you do have to say no to people, and there are people who are, their lives kind of depend on some of these loans and things. So it's a tough deal. But what I'm seeing here, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm seeing by choosing customer first, access to a ton of information, a ton of predictive information, data that down the road helps you build a technology stack that can assess and address those people who probably would be the best bets, who probably deserve the most lending, deserve the most, you know, credit room, whatever the case may be. You can build the tech that makes smarter decisions than everybody else because you know more about your customers than everybody else.
Yeah.
Is that on par?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, so I started the first company in 92 and I ran that for 8 years. So it was a great training ground because it was a flawed business model, and the reason why it was a flawed business model is because we didn't have a great value proposition to any of our customers, right? And so I just thought, when you think about scale,
yeah,
right, and being able to build something that is going to be something that is real value to the consumer and something that you could get up every day. And I always said, you know, you could feel like, you know, you got the current moving you downstream versus feeling like, you know, how many entrepreneurs feel like they're pushing a boulder up a hill,
yeah,
right? It's not a good feeling to be feeling like you're pushing a boulder up a hill every day. So there's something that's wrong, right? And so ultimately, when we started with the concept of, all right, we have three customers. We have the customer we're doing the loan for, loan officers that we're working with, and referral partners, being real estate agents, financial planners, business, you know, developers, things like that, who refer us their customers. So in order to really scale and feel like you're swimming downstream, you got to be able to build, what my thought was, we have to build the best value proposition to all of our customers, to all three customers, than any other bank or mortgage company in the country. And if we do that and we stay consistent to that, then we should be able to stay, you know, where things seem to flow, yeah. right? And things seem to work. So technology is a major component to that, right? Price is a major component. Service is a major component. So there's, and then there's more depending on your customer, but those are really key things. And the thing is, it's easy to say it. It's really hard to actually make that happen, you know, and have it be meaningful from a company standpoint and not just one or a small group of individuals being able to deliver that, that the company overall can deliver that.
All that on a couple of months writing loans and doing cold calls telemarketing. Yeah, right. People going to college and they got the wrong idea. No, it's you make a great point. I make light of it, but it's just true. There are certain people I think are paying attention. Like I don't even know what movie this is, but the line I'm stealing from is essentially, are you living a conscious life? I think a lot of people are wandering around with their head up their ass. They don't realize like 3 months of writing loans is a lot of practice. Two nights a week even of learning like how to sell it.
Well, actually it was those 3 nights, but then I started a company in 92 to 2000. So I ran, my first company was called Guaranteed Financial Mortgage, yeah. and I ran that for 8 years.
No, I was joking about the initial part, but you get the eight years of like testing this theory.
100%.
And then being able to, I mean, I'm trying to find the way to do this. It's not like spinning into a new business as much as it's just flat out recognizing like we could do this even better. And starting anew with just everything you learned.
No, it's exactly what it was. I mean, it was everything that I didn't want to be,
yep.
right? Is more so than what I was representing of what I wanted to be, yeah. right? I mean, I think it was more of that than anything. And then it was our core values were really important to me, which was because I had employees that were not good employees, right? But I was 24 years old yeah. when I first started the thing in a crappy little office, and I had, you know, no capital, and it was brutal, you know, and it was like, you know, beating your head against the wall every single day. So one of the core values was for sure customer first, like yep. you said, but another one was best of the best. Like yeah. if I'm going to build this thing, I want the best mortgage professionals on every level. I want the best closers. I want the best underwriters. I want best loan officers. I want everyone to be the best. I want to be an elite, you know, group. I'd rather have less people who are more skilled and working with the right people who care, right? And I know one of our core values, I don't know if you could even say it, is we give a shit, yeah. right? You have to care. You have to care about the employee. You have to care about the other employees around you. You have to care about your customers. You have to care about everybody, you know, as far as in the ecosystem. And how many people, you know, are getting something at a store, or you're communicating with people who clearly don't care. Right?
The line that I used for this, and talking about the people part of this,
yeah.
the employees, one, first off, it's incredibly difficult as a leader and a founder to like get over yourself and recognize that we're not going to do anything here unless we have great people. Like I need to hire people who are smarter than me because this is not like, this isn't going to go anywhere.
Yeah.
But the line that I always have in my head is when giving advice on hiring people, it's the, you're going to hire five, you're going to work them like 10, but you're going to pay them like 8. And if you do that, you generally get people who want to be there. They want to bust their ass. You pay them well enough that it's worth their time and they feel appreciated. And if yeah. they do that, it's much easier for you to say, we give a shit, because they do. They're benefit for it. And therefore the customer also, everybody wins.
Yeah. Yeah. No doubt.
Very good yeah. business, obviously. It's a very cool story here. Now, I want to lastly kind of close on the foundation stuff. What are some of the things that over your time and I got to suspect because of your upbringing and the way things kind of went, and you went from, you know, going crazy to going to Columbia to painting on people's sidewalks, like what are the things you care about and how do you get to serve them now?
Yeah. And honestly, it's such a rewarding part of where I'm at. What I didn't want to do is I joined a board for Children's Memorial, and it's unbelievable hospital, and I was and still passionate about, you know, their what they're doing and all the things, but I was part of their board and I just wasn't making a difference. I kept trying to say I want to do this, I want to do that, and they're like, we got this fundraiser, just yeah. support it. We got this fundraiser,
put your money
support
here.
That right. And so I was like, I kind of want to do my own thing, you know. And so I looked at it and I said, all right, well, who else would I rather help than my network, right? Yep. And the employees and their friends and family. And so we started doing a few things here and there, like, you know, somebody would get sick, someone would have cancer, God, you know, and we started helping out individuals. And then from there, I said, all right, I think this is the foundation that we want to start. And the foundation's philosophy was we help out individuals who are in desperate need of help, you know? And then from there, it has grown outside of the business to helping out people who are homeless, women who are in domestic violence shelters, and helping them get established in a new place, in all different areas. People who are going through serious hardship, and they just need, you know, kind of that reach out,
someone
that helping
to find
hand.
Them.
Yeah, and so people always ask, like, it's got to be tough to know who really needs it and who doesn't, right? Yeah. And I said, there's no doubt it's difficult. But what we do is we work with the third-party shelters, right? Yep. So we'll actually work with a domestic violence shelter where we have somebody there that will say, of all the people that I've worked with, this person really needs help. And they're not going back into the situation that they were once in. Their kids are here. They're going through a program. They're working through it. And at that point, we then will do an assessment and getting more personal information about them. In a lot of those situations, you're getting police reports of the incident or incidents that have occurred.
So something to sort of verify what's going on.
You're getting full verification, and then from there we have a voting committee, and then typically it's a meaningful thing where we're usually paying for about a year of rent,
yep,
and a security deposit, and then mainly
enough to
them
give them something to actually get off the ground rather 100%. Than just sort of
just give them a chance to breathe. Give them a chance to like get resettled and move on with their lives. We've bought I think over 8 cars now, just last week we have now hit over the $3 million mark.
Nice.
Where we've given and to individual people in helping them. So
I think it's fantastic. I mean, obviously, you know, our focus has always been on, I think, kids in general, education, STEM education, you know, gender equality, racial equality, being able to help everyone have a kind of a democratized experience of tech and giving people the opportunity to get involved in these kind of businesses where previously they really haven't. So I totally can relate to the understanding that I was very fortunate and that I was able to screw up all over the place, and I still got my shot multiple times. I've swung and missed multiple times.
Yeah.
And some people don't get any single shot. And it's like, you have to, if you can do something successful, you can get yourself in a position, and it doesn't have to be up the top. I mean, it could be like along the way, can I just leave some breadcrumbs or something? So I totally get it. Very cool. Where do people go to, if they can back that, if they can get behind it, where do people go to learn more about the foundation?
They could just go to the website, rate.com, go there, and there'll be information on the foundation. It's completely transparent foundation. So all the money that has been given to our, you know, people that we've helped is clear. We put it all on there. There's not a penny that goes into the foundation that goes to expenses.
Yep.
That's a really key component. The company pays.
It's an actual foundation, believe it or not, in this day and age where people, you know,
so much of the money is going to salaries and expenses and things like that. And so that's the other thing is like, I was like, that's not something that I want anyone to feel like they're putting money into a foundation to go to someone's salary.
Yeah.
So the company covers all the expenses of the foundation. So now every penny that goes in is really going to go to somebody that's in desperate need of help. So
that's awesome.
Yeah. Thanks.
Victor, I appreciate you taking all the time with us.
Yeah,
this has been super fascinating. Is there any place people follow you? Do you do social?
I
feel like you
don't, but I need to. I keep thinking.
At this point, things are going well. I feel like at this point, you jump into it and it's probably not good.
Yeah, maybe.
You might tell people what you really think and then everything gets on a slide.
Yeah, could be.
It's probably better that we don't follow you.
Right.
Regardless, I really appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah,
this is awesome.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
Of course, you can learn more about upcoming Technori events, investment opportunities. Check out the blog at technori.com. Download this podcast and many more on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Follow us on social at Technori. We have Technori. Or you can follow me at Katoon. Boom. That's a wrap.